When we look out at the universe, we see that it is full of objects, stars, dust, gas, and maybe most importantly, galaxies. There are trillions upon trillions of galaxies within our visible universe. Most of them are small and low mass, but the large ones, the ones that are around the Milky Way size or larger, have billions or trillions of stars in them, and they also have a central concentration of mass. Stars, gas, dust sometimes, and black holes almost always. At the centers of these black holes is sometimes an accretion disk, sometimes is matter, and sometimes that matter works to feed the black hole. And when it does, when that black hole starts devouring matter, it becomes active. Active galaxies behave very differently than quiet ones. And that's going to be the topic of this episode that you should stay tuned for right here on the Starts With a Bang podcast. Whenever a galaxy starts devouring matter at its supermassive black holes are messy eaters. They don't simply swallow everything that comes into contact with them. Most of the matter gets funneled into an accretion disk or a set of accretion flows where it heats up, gets accelerated, and gets ejected. We emit streams of matter and radiation, particles, photons, all across the electromagnetic spectrum. These are called active galaxies. They evolve, they feed back onto the galaxies that host them, and there's a huge connection between these active galactic nuclei and the galaxies that house them. And here to help us explore that, I'm so pleased to welcome Skylar Grayson to the podcast. Skylar is a PhD candidate at Arizona State University, and I am so excited to have her here. Skylar, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah. So, you know, when I think about galaxies, my go-to is always the Milky Way. But we, even though we have a supermassive black hole, and it's pretty substantial, it's more than 4 million solar masses, we're not really an active galaxy, are we?
No, we're not. And it's probably for the best.
Well, what is it that makes a galaxy active? What do we need to see in order for us to classify a galaxy as having an active galactic nucleus?
So there's a bunch of different ways that a galaxy can have an active galactic nuclei. And when we talk about these AGN, it's not a monolith. They display a lot of different properties. But typically, it's an AGN when you have a bunch of material around your supermassive black hole that's being eaten up at relatively high rates. And when that starts to happen, you start to, like you mentioned at the top, get these outflows of energy or even particles. And so when we talk about an AGN, we're talking about actually being able to see some sort of observable activity around the core of a galaxy.
So what do I use to see this? Is this something that I would be able to see with a run-of-the-mill telescope when I look in visible light at optical wavelengths? Is it something that I could better detect at either X-ray high energy or radio low energy wavelengths? Or does it really depend on the system in question?
It definitely depends on the system in question, but it can span the whole electromagnetic spectrum. So when we talk about very high energy X-ray type emission, we're thinking of hot material, really high energy gas that can be in the process of falling into your black hole. You can get X-ray emission from that. But on the other end of the spectrum, we can have very long wavelength radio emission in what we call radio galaxies. A lot of times we see radio lobes, which are big structures of ejected material that extend way beyond the actual observable stellar range of the galaxy. We kind of first started seeing AGN in the form of quasars, which are these quasi-stellar objects. We thought they might be stars, and then as our observational abilities improved, we could figure out that they were actually way too far away for them to be stars in our galaxy. And we determined that these are actually AGN. These are galaxies with a very active black hole that's emitting a lot of radiation that are very, very far away, billions of light years away. And these quasars can be pretty obvious in a range of wavelengths, but you have to have a sensitive enough telescope to actually detect distant objects to see them.
You know, it's kind of messed up when I think about the history of this, that originally the word quasar came from an acronym. It's because it was a quasi-stellar radio source, the QSRS, and that's where we got the word quasars from. Then we started seeing things where we imaged more deeply and found, oh, well, a bunch of these quasars, they actually have galaxies that host them, that these quasars live within galaxies, but the galaxies are often very faint and far away. Then we started discovering, you know what, there are some nearby galaxies that also display this central activity. They might not be as energetic or luminous as these distant, powerful quasars, but nearby galaxies like Messier 87 at the heart of the Virgo cluster, you know, that we got our famous image of our first directly imaged event horizon for a black hole from. That's an active galaxy. Centaurus A is a very interesting active galaxy that exhibits both X-ray and huge radio lobe emissions. So I think when you start talking about this, it's important for me to remember, you know, Ethan, when you were learning about these objects, you learned about quasars, and you learned about AGNs, and you learned about blazars, and these were all different classes of objects. And today, we don't think that anymore. We think, nope, these are the same classes of objects, just some are closer and fainter, some are brighter and more distant, some are face-on, where that jet is pointing directly at us, that's what makes it a blazar, and others we see kind of edge-on, where we see, you know, there's like this flat disk in the middle that gets very hot, and then these two bipolar lobes that come out perpendicular to the disk. You know, for someone like you, who is a little bit more junior in astronomy than I am, you probably never learned that all of these things were separate and then had to learn they're all the same thing. You probably came up learning, oh yeah, these are all the same things, and that was just like the standard knowledge that you learned with.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely kind of came into it with the idea of it's all due to activity around the supermassive black hole. Now, that being said, there is a lot we still very much don't understand about what's going on down there. There's still a lot of open questions, but at least we do know it is coming from that galactic core.
Well, let me look at those two relatively nearby galaxies I brought up. Messier 87, which is a giant elliptical that has jets that you can see in the X-ray, in the radio, and even in the optical, even in visible light, extending for thousands of light years coming out of that central nucleus. But Messier 87 is a relatively gas-poor galaxy. It's not forming a lot of new stars, but it still has this intense stellar activity. By contrast, a galaxy like Centaurus A is a disk galaxy. It has a lot of gas. It has a lot of dust. It's forming new stars actively. And it also has this intense central activity where it emits light all across the electromagnetic spectrum. Is this sort of common? Can we see galactic activity with an AGN, with an active galactic nucleus, in any type of galaxy? Or Are these kind of like, well, one is common and one is rare? What do we find when we sort of examine the AGNs we find out there and try and take a census and classify them? What are the common types of galaxies with AGNs, and what are the rare ones?
So that's a really interesting question, and it's actually kind of the motivation for all of my dissertation research can be answered in the answer to that question. But the sort of thing that we see with something like M87, where you have this big elliptical galaxy that's pretty much done forming stars, is relatively rare. So when we look at the AGN activity in galaxies, we see them in the biggest galaxies in the universe, typically ones that are, you know, Milky Way sized or bigger. And so those big galaxies do tend to be ellipticals, at least by the modern universe. But we also see AGN activity kind of correlating with stellar growth. So when we look at the star formation rates in the universe in these really massive galaxies, we see that they started out kind of low and as the first galaxies were forming, and those rates increased over time. And then something happened around a redshift of 2, which is around 10 billion years ago, I believe, where since that point, the most massive galaxies sort of stopped forming stars and became these ellipticals. And in that same period of time, we saw a similar trend in the luminosity that we see when we look at AGN-like quasars. We see bigger, brighter quasars, and then around a redshift of 2, that number starts to decrease. So it's thought that when you have a galaxy that is forming a lot of stars, it has a lot of gas reservoirs, it has a lot of dust reservoirs, there's also a lot of stuff to feed that supermassive black hole. And then as that supermassive black hole begins to display these feedback behaviors that we're talking about, it can heat up the gas, it can remove the gas from the galaxy, and that prevents further star formation, and so they sort of become these ellipticals. But as soon as that starts to happen, you run out of material for the black hole to eat as well, and so that AGN behavior stops. So we see the AGN behavior in these big elliptical-type galaxies kind of early on in the universe, but in the modern universe, it's a lot more rare. We think that when these galaxies have sort of run out of the gas to form stars, a lot of times they've also run out of the gas to feed their supermassive black holes.
That's a really good answer. Thank you for that. So if I'm understanding what you said correctly, what you're sort of telling me is there is a connection between the activity we see at a galaxy's center around its supermassive black hole, and in general, the overall star formation properties of that galaxy. If I go and I map out the history of the universe and how stars have formed over the history of the universe, you know, I think it's really fascinating. A lot of people have been sort of looking at the latest James Webb Space Telescope data and saying, wow, look at how bright and common massive galaxies were so early on. Look how many stars they had. Look how massive they had to be. Look how fast they've had to grow up. Well, it turns out, even with everything that JWST has seen, star formation remains relatively low in the universe over the first not only few hundred million years, but over the first billion or 2 years. The star formation rate rises and rises. And then when the universe is 3 billion years old or so, it hits its peak. Star formation hits this peak value where it's forming the greatest number of stars that it'll ever form. And slowly, like you said, about 10 billion years ago, that star formation rate started to decrease. And we can sort of imagine why this would happen, right? When things are early on in the universe, they're also denser, they're closer together, and gravitational collapse is happening in various locations. So as galaxies form, they grow, they accrete matter from their surroundings, they draw clumps of matter in. They also draw other galaxies, small and large, into them, so galactic mergers are more common. And whenever you have these sort of violent events where things accrete, get drawn in, merge, etc., you're going to produce more and more new stars. You're going to trigger episodes of star formation. And if some of that matter makes it onto that central black hole, you're going to activate that central black hole as well. So I guess it shouldn't come as a surprise that right around when we see star formation peaking, that's also when we see the greatest populations of the brightest quasars happening. And then as we come to sort of late times in the universe, they become more rare. And yeah, you can still have active galaxies, but generally that's only going to occur where you either have galactic mergers or you have the infall of matter onto a galaxy, and in particular, onto a galaxy's black hole. Is that a fair broad overview of where we find these objects and a story we tell ourselves about how they came to be?
Yeah, I think that's a great summary of it. It's interesting. I'm what we would call a computational astrophysicist. So most of the work that I do is with big cosmological scale simulations where I'm not actually working with data from telescopes, but rather from simulations that model how things like dark matter and gas interact over cosmic time and scales. And with these simulations, we see that if you don't include AGN feedback, if you don't include this type of quasar behavior, we don't see the same sort of star formation trend. Instead of it reaching that peak around 10 billion years ago, galaxies will continue to merge and accrete gas and continue forming stars and growing bigger. So AGN feedback, at least from a computational perspective, is crucial to just replicate sort of the basic masses that we see in galaxies today.
So the word feedback gets used a lot, and for someone who's not an astronomer, they might not be familiar with it in an astronomy context. When I think of the word feedback, you know, from an astrophysics perspective, the simplest way I've ever been able to explain it is something happens that causes a release of energy, and that released energy then prevents something that would otherwise happen a lot from happening a lot.
I think that's a great summary.
So in the context of AGNs, we would say, oh, right, well, you have, you know, matter falls onto these central black holes, and these central black holes, you know, accelerate it, heat it up. Because it's made of things like protons and electrons, when they start moving, they generate magnetic fields, and those magnetic fields accelerate charged particles, and that produces radiation and also emits particles. So you say, okay, great. Where does that radiation go? And the answer is some of it goes out into the universe, streams away in these jets, and we can see them, and they don't do a whole lot. The jets don't do a whole lot in general to the galaxy itself. But other places that energy gets injected go straight into the gas and dust and other material that's in the galaxy itself. That's the material that you would make new stars out of. But if you hit it with enough energy, you're going to heat it up, you're going to evaporate some of it, you might even expel it. If you can get it going fast enough and inject enough energy into it, you might eject it from the galaxy entirely and spew it out into the intergalactic medium. And this seems to be important because it's that material, it's that neutral matter that's made out of light elements that primarily goes into forming new stars. So is it fair to say that feedback from active galaxies and quasars not only can do things like bring an end to star formation episodes that are occurring, but it can hinder a galaxy from forming new stars even billions of years down the line?
Yeah, that's sort of the most commonly accepted thought process now. And honestly, even when you have something like jet behavior that's putting material way outside of the galaxy, even that can prevent star formation in the sense that if you're depositing energy into what we call the circumgalactic medium, this gas that's around galaxies that oftentimes is in the process of gravitationally falling into the galaxies, if you have processes that deposit energy in the circumgalactic medium, it can heat that material up so that it doesn't fall into the galaxy and thus doesn't go into those reservoirs that can form new stars. So even if you're not impacting the material directly in the galaxy, if you're impacting the material outside of the galaxy, that too can prevent star formation many, many years down the line.
Is that what I'm seeing when I see these pictures of galaxies like Hercules A that have these giant radio lobes? You have an active galaxy and it is spewing out energy, and that energy is smashing into clouds of gas or clouds of matter that are out there, and that's what's causing it to glow?
Yep, absolutely. You get shock heating as you get this material from the AGN hitting these gas reservoirs in the circumgalactic medium, and that heats it up, and we get these beautiful, beautiful displays that, you know, can help us understand a lot about how AGN processes work and also how they impact their galaxies.
You know, one of the things I've been really curious about for a long time, and I don't know that we've ever seen the switch happen, but in theory, you know, you have these galaxies, and it's not like, oh, this is an active galaxy and it's always been an active galaxy and it will always be an active galaxy. It's really more like, you know, galaxies in general go through active and quiet phases. They go through periods of great star forming activity called starbursts, and they go through periods where they have only what we call quiescent star formation, where you don't have anything majorly disruptive happening to the galaxy, and it just sort of produces stars at a low rate from its own internal dynamics, maybe similar to what's happening in the Milky Way today. But galactic nuclei are supposedly similar, right? Like, it takes matter actively feeding this central black hole to activate it and keep it active. And once that matter gets used up or blown away, we expect these quasars or blazars or AGNs to turn off. Have we ever seen an object that was off turn on a galactic scale like this? Or alternatively, have we ever seen an active galaxy suddenly quiet down and stop being active? Or have we not been observing the universe long enough to see these things turn on and off on decade-ish timescales on the scale of a human lifetime?
Yeah, that's a great question. And to be completely honest, I'm not entirely certain. Now, I know that when these supermassive black holes are going through their active phases, these can last millions of years, very long time scales compared to a human lifespan. I believe that we have seen observational evidence of kind of big events when a black hole swallows, say, a star, and there's a lot of energy that's released in the process of swallowing like one big massive object like that, that we can observe more in the local universe. But when we look at galaxies really far away, galaxies that are in this peak of quasar activity, there's not going to be that much change over time, because the scales of human life compared to the scales of the universe are not really comparable.
Yeah, I mean, you expect, you know, what, 100,000 years, million years, tens of millions of years, maybe even hundreds of millions of years for some of these periods of quasar or AGN activity. And what, humans haven't been doing astronomy for anywhere near that long. Let me ask you then, do we see these active galaxies and say, you're active or you're not? Or are there different stages of evolution that these active galaxies go through? And when you look at an active galaxy, you can sort of say like, oh, it's turned on recently, or oh, it's been on for a very long time. Are there signatures that you can look for, or I guess theoretically that you can sort of expect to see in a galaxy's lifetime over, you know, a period of central activity like this?
So this is one of the big questions in the field right now. And there's a couple of different ways I want to answer this. The first is that, you know, AGN feedback is not a monolith. We talked about how we had all these different things, quasars and blazars and Seyfert galaxies, and we determined they were all kind of the same process. But there's also changes in how AGN behave based on how quickly they are accreting material. So when these supermassive black holes are eating up a bunch of material really quickly, we tend to get a lot of energy in the form of radiation. You get a lot of light that's coming from these supermassive black holes, think quasars. But if that accretion rate slows down, that tends to be associated with more kinetic feedback. So in these cases, a lot of the energy isn't coming from radiation, but rather from just ejecting material away from your black hole. And so galaxies can definitely go through different phases in terms of what their AGN are doing based on how quickly they're accreting and how much stuff there is to accrete around them. In terms of looking at galaxies and trying to tell how long they've been active, things like that, we start to probe the gas that's around galaxies, partially just because when we look at the distant universe, it's hard to resolve the scales of galaxies unless you have an extraordinary tool like JWST. And so we look on broader scales to see how AGN has impacted kind of big regions of gas. And this is a very active field of research. This is kind of the focus of my dissertation. How can we constrain what these AGN are doing by looking at the gas around galaxies? And people are trying a lot of different ways to do it, and we still don't really have set answers yet.
I mean, that sounds really important, right? Because what I would expect is whenever I have these violent events, you know, a merger, a major accretion event, I don't know, maybe a pinball-like event where a globular cluster goes and just like happens to pass through the center of a galaxy where the black hole is, you know, you can imagine all sorts of events that would cause a galaxy to activate. And it seems like most of these events would also correlate with an increased amount of star formation. So when you sort of say, well, it's going to feed back on the gas, I say, well, hang on, that gas is what's required to form new stars. And in particular, gas has to get cold in order for new stars to form. Otherwise, when you gravitationally collapse, if that energy can't escape, if you have too much of it, if you can't cool rapidly enough, you're going to be too hot. And as you compress down and get hotter, it's going to push you back out and you won't be able to gravitationally collapse. So I would sort of think, would central AGN-like activity, if you have an active galactic nucleus, would that do something called quench star formation? Would that say like, nope, we've got too much energy in here and all the stars you formed up until now are all I'm going to let you form because I'm going to inject too much energy into you and I'm going to feed back on the galaxy and that's going to bring an end to this star formation episode?
Yes, that is definitely the kind of current line of thought. There's still uncertainty in terms of how that quenching actually happens, in terms of is it actually expelling the gas or is it just heating the gas up? If it's heating the gas up, how much is it heating the gas up by? These are some of the big questions that we're trying to answer right now.
And I would imagine you see a variety, right? I would imagine that in like the biggest, most massive galaxies, you know, you can, even if you have a full-fledged quasar, a super energetic one, you're going to have a hard time ejecting the gas from that big, massive clump that you're just going to have like, yeah, there's just too much gravity here. This gas might get energized and might get blown into the galaxy's outskirts. But between the normal matter inside and the dark matter in the halo, it's not going anywhere. Whereas for a smaller, lower mass galaxy, you know, even one that's not active, like our nearby cigar galaxy, Messier 82, you can say, oh, well, you get strong enough winds from the galactic center, and you can blow all that gas out of there, and that's going to leave you with a gas-depleted galaxy that might have difficulty forming future generations of stars hundreds of millions or billions of years down the road.
Yeah, I think that there's definitely an element of, you know, the circumstance of the galaxy has a big impact on what the AGN is doing. Part of the problem is we're looking at galaxies that are 10 billion light years away. And so we can't necessarily see with our telescopes the scales of star formation. We can't necessarily directly see these winds and know what is physically happening. And so we have to kind of take approximations or look at the effects on larger scales to know for sure what's going on. And so we're kind of limited by the instruments that we have to understand these details.
Well, but even so, I would imagine you still have ways you can probe it, even if it's not, you know, directly like we could probe for those nearby galaxies we talked about, Messier 82, Messier 87, Centaurus A, Hercules A. Like, these galaxies, they're nearby. We can see them in detail. We can resolve all these different parts of them, even without having to resort to like flagship space telescopes. But like you said, if you're looking several billion or 10 billion plus light years away, all of a sudden this galaxy is going to appear much smaller and fainter, and you're not really going to be able to resolve very much of it. But I still think you can do things. For example, the entire universe is backlit by this almost uniform bath of radiation that's left over from the Big Bang, the cosmic microwave background, right? It's this black body spectrum of radiation. I think there are 411 photons per cubic centimeter everywhere in the universe coming from it. It appears in all directions, and it's all at about the same temperature, this 2.7255 Kelvin, with, you know, variations that show up at the tens or maybe hundreds of microkelvin levels. And I think, well, hang on a second. If you have gas or plasma or material in the way of the cosmic microwave background, it's going to do something remarkable. Back in the 1960s, Rashid Sunyaev and Yakov Zeldovich, they wrote this paper saying, hey, if you pass light through, you know, a hot region of gas, you're going to get a boost to that light's energy. You're going to get something that we call the thermal Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect. On the other hand, if you have gas that's moving relative to the line of sight that you're looking at this bath of radiation at, you're also going to get either a positive boost or a negative boost to that light's energy, and that's called the kinetic Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect. Is it possible to use either the thermal or kinetic Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect with this sort of backlit light to sort of learn properties about the active galactic nucleus, to learn properties about what's going on in this galaxy that we're trying to examine, even when we can't resolve these AGN features directly like we can for the nearby galaxies?
Absolutely. And this is sort of the main tool that I'm using right now in my research, is the thermal Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect. And part of the reason why it's so useful is that, you know, as you explained really wonderfully, the cosmic microwave background, this light that's coming at us from everywhere, it's going to gain energy from the hot gas that it passes through on its way to us. And the amount of energy it gains directly depends on the pressure of that gas. And so we can look at the cosmic microwave background, and we can look at it in regions where it's passing these galaxies that we care about, and we can determine things about the pressure and the conditions in the gas around these galaxies. And in theory, the pressure profile of the gas would vary depending on if there's AGN feedback, if there was AGN feedback in the past, if AGN feedback did different things. So with my research, what I am doing is I'm taking these cosmological simulations and I'm changing how they do the AGN feedback. And then I'm looking to see if that has an impact on the thermal Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect around these big galaxies 10 billion years ago. And what we're starting to see is that, yes, this signal, this thing that can track the pressure of gas around galaxies, is sensitive to changes in what the AGN are doing, which is really exciting because it can kind of finally help us understand a bit better how the feedback is impacting the galaxies at these distances where we can't see it in detail.
You know, that's wonderful. I feel like this is one of my favorite and the most underappreciated parts of cosmology. A lot of people, they look at things like dark matter or active galaxies or something that happened in the past and isn't happening anymore. And they sort of think like, oh, well, this is indirect evidence. And if you're not seeing it directly, how can you really be sure? And I don't think people really appreciate, well, hang on. We understand the physics of what goes on in, say, normal matter, right? You inject energy into normal matter, and depending on the spectrum of energy, the amount of energy, the wavelength of the light that carries that energy, you're going to see a certain set of effects that you can predict because it's just physics. Matter obeys the laws of physics, and where you have physical processes happening, that allows you to compute what's going to happen to the matter. And then when you have things like, oh, well, here's what we can observe, you say, well, if I understand these are the physical processes happening, then this is how they're going to affect what I can observe. So when I go and I make my observations and I collect them, I can compare them with the different things I predict should be happening under a different set of circumstances. And that allows me to say, oh, galaxies 1, 4, and 7, they're active right now, and I can tell from the signature I see. And galaxies 2, 3, and 5, they were active recently, but they're not active now, but I can still see the leftover signature of their recent activity showing up. And galaxies 6, 8, and 9, they're just normal, quiet galaxies, and they have been for as far as we can detect it. And I think that's a really powerful probe because it allows us to say, look, We don't see these things nearby. We can't get those observations that ideally you would want. But here are the observations we can get, and here's what it means. Here's what those observations mean for these distant objects. So even though you only have indirect evidence, this is very powerful indirect evidence. And as you build up large statistics of these samples, you can start to categorize, hey, this is what's going on. And if you really need to, you can say, look, you can also go and get follow-up observations with ALMA or JWST or a flagship telescope or observatory to actually show, hey, in this one object where we had the indirect evidence for it, we can actually see some direct evidence, and that will help validate your whole picture.
Yeah, I think that we are in a really wonderful phase of astrophysics just as a field right now because of our ability to use these computational methods. One of the big problems with astronomy as a field is we're talking about things that are so far away that we'll never be able to travel to and that we don't have any control over. So, you know, the sort of classic scientific method, I do an experiment, I have a control group, I see what's different between them, and I, you know, can figure out what effects they have, is a lot harder when we can't actually control what's going on in the universe. But with our simulations, we can. We can have control over if the feedback is really kinetic, if it's how fast the winds are moving, how much energy is being deposited into the gas. We can play with those variables and see what happens. And then we can turn to the universe and see which of our, you know, different simulations aligns well with what's actually going on. And we weren't able to do this really well even just a few decades ago because these simulations require a lot of time. They're all run on these massive supercomputing clusters and require a lot of complicated code. And so as our computational abilities have improved, it's helped us find a way to more directly experiment with the universe, which I think is really fun. And I feel very grateful to be able to do astrophysics in this era when we have these simulations to compare against the universe.
You know, I think this is really wonderful because for most of the 20th century, what you're talking about wasn't really possible. There were only three types of astronomers for a long time. You had theorists who, you know, focused mostly on the physics and calculated what you'd expect to be out there, and in some cases could either tell observers what to look for or could interpret the observations that were out there and say, oh, this is what they indicate, this is what they're all about. We also had observers, of course, who would go out and make the observations and say, I'm looking at these objects, here's what I'm seeing, and they would report on them. And we also had instrument builders or instrumentalists who would make the telescopes and cameras and the instruments that would observe and record the data. So between instrumentalists and observers and theorists, those were the three main types of astronomer astrophysicists that were out there. And now there is a fourth type. There are computational astrophysicists. And I generally class even computational astrophysicists into two categories. I would say there are the computational astrophysicists who focus on machine learning and artificial intelligence and large data sets and try and say, okay, we can make these mock catalogs and we can sort of say, here's what a large data set would look like, and we train the computer on itself, we train the program on itself to find the classes of objects we're interested in and sort them and classify them and look for these certain details. But you also have people who write simulations, who say, well, I'm going to take the inputs from the theory, and instead of saying, well, I only have one universe to observe, I better hope what I want is out there, you say, no, I'm going to simulate the aspects of the universe I'm interested in, and I'm going to vary the initial conditions, and I'm going to see what sort of observable signatures these simulations tell me I should get out of it. In a big way, I think that type of simulator, the type of computational astrophysicist that you are, is an invaluable bridge between theory and observation that, you know, really helps us sort of understand, well, look, you've been seeing these things and maybe you don't know what they are, or you can see these things and maybe you don't know that these are the things you should be looking for based on the physics that is underlying them. And that simulation bridge between theory and observation can really be such a powerful tool that I'm really pleased that in the 21st century, computational astrophysicist is its own type of astrophysicist that is kind of unique from both theory and observation.
Yeah, I really like the word that you used of being the bridge, because I think there has kind of been a longstanding issue of people not necessarily talking to each other on either side of that. I have experience doing very theory-heavy research where it felt like I could just play around with the math for a whole career and not necessarily know if anything I was doing was actually what was going on in the universe. And so it became really important to me to find a way to do this sort of theoretical playing around with, you know, what's happening in the universe, but also have a way to check it, have a way to see, you know, if is this right? Is this going on? Can we tell? And that's one of the reasons that I am doing the research that I'm doing. I think it's really important to have people who can, you know, be in both worlds a little bit and talk to both sets of people and help everyone learn more together.
You know, I'm going to share a little personal story I had back when I was in graduate school and we were in the era of three types of astrophysicists, where if you were a theorist, you would do some computational work, or if you were an observer, you would deal with the large data sets manually, but there wasn't really that much that was a specialized I'm a computational astrophysicist and computational is my jam. I got some advice from an observer that I worked with. Even though I was a theorist, I did one observational paper, and he was extremely enthusiastic for me to learn about observation because he was telling me between theory, observation, and instrumentation, most astronomers and astrophysicists only know one. They only know what's going on in their own world, and they only know what's cutting edge in that world. That's it. The theorists don't know what observations are coming in, and they don't know how to play nice with the observations or with the data. And the observers don't really know where the theorists are coming from. They're not the ones who are doing the calculations and understanding what they're going to be. And the instrumentationalists, they don't necessarily even know what the observers are using their instruments to do or trying to find. They just know the capabilities of their instruments really well. And he told me, you don't need to learn all three, but if you can learn two of them, that will be like incredibly profound, and that will give you an advantage over people who only know one. And I feel like now with computational astrophysics, you can't really be a good computational astrophysicist unless you also know either theory or observation or a little bit of both really well.
Yeah, I fully agree. I think I'm definitely, just personally, a little more on the theory side still. Since you shared an anecdote, I am also going to share one. I recently had the opportunity to go and give a talk to a cosmology group at another university, and they were doing work where they were comparing their observations against a big suite of different simulations, and they were just kind of seeing where they fell compared to what was being simulated. And I went and I gave a talk about all the different things that go into these simulations and what's well constrained and what's not. We're still pretty early in this field of computational astrophysics. There's definitely a lot of approximations still and kinks to be worked out. And so I kind of helped explain some of the built-in uncertainties that go into these results that they're comparing against. And then they were able to tell me about the work that they're doing constraining big cosmological parameters, like the fraction of the energy in the universe that's in matter or dark energy. And I sort of had this moment of, oh, there's error bars on these values, these numbers that I just put into these simulations and never think about again. There's this whole other side to how these things are determined. And so I think, you know, that was a moment for me to be like, I've been a bit too into the theory side of it lately, and I forget that I'm also building off of observation and that there's uncertainties and approximations and methods that I should be aware of. And I don't think I would have been able to do that if I didn't have the chance to actually, you know, see how these simulations were used in comparison with observation. And I think continuing to have those discussions is really important.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, our understanding of so many things has changed profoundly, you know, since I was in graduate school 20 years ago. But also, like, just over the last few years, a whole slew of things have changed. If you would have asked me 20 years ago, how much of the universe's energy is locked up in the form of black holes, I would have given you a number that was around, you know, something times 10 to the minus 5 of the total energy density. And today, we know that that is crazy low. We know that actually something like something times 10 to the minus 3 of the universe is in the form of black holes, that black holes are much more abundant and represent a much greater fraction of the mass in the universe than we thought they did 20 years ago. And a lot of this advance has only come about in the last 8 years since we've been detecting gravitational waves directly and measuring the black hole population directly. And something like that, you know, for a lot of people, that's just a tiny little detail, and oh, big deal, this number that we thought was this number is now tens or maybe even 100 times bigger than we thought it was. But if you're someone who cares about I don't know, black holes at the centers of galaxies that accelerate matter and put out energy into them, you're going to care about that difference tremendously. And just knowing that observations have changed the parameters that you're going to need to put into your model, if you missed that detail, it would be transformative in a catastrophic way for your simulations.
Yeah, I fully agree. I think that it's perhaps gotten a little bit better because simulations are now used more broadly for comparison, but there's still a gap. And I think there's still kind of a communication barrier between theorists and a computational astrophysicist and the observers. And I think that that is something that I'm definitely going to try to think about a lot over my career, because I think it's really important.
Let me ask you, when it comes to these distant galaxies, these active galaxies, or these either future or formerly active galaxies, I have thought of a bunch of questions that I've already asked you about them, but I want to know, what are some of the biggest unanswered questions that you're curious about when it comes to this class of objects? What are some of the things that you hope to, by time you get to the end of your career, that you hope are, they're big questions now that you hope will get answered?
I think the biggest overarching question is just, how does the energy go from this accretion disk around a black hole back into the gas in and around a galaxy? Because we have a general sense that the gas can be moved around and it can be heated up, but in terms of the real underlying physical mechanisms at play, there's a lot of uncertainties. And from my perspective, every single big simulation treats this process a little bit differently, and they can't all be right. And I would really love to know which one is, or at the very least, you know, what are the efficiencies at play? How good are these AGN at converting energy from the accretion disk into, let's say, thermal energy in the gas around them in the galaxy? There's a lot of small questions that I focus on in my everyday research concerning those parameters, but the big one is just, how does this energy transfer happen?
I mean, that's such a good one, right? Because, you know, so I can imagine what's going on in the center of an active galaxy around the black hole. I can imagine we've got normal matter, it's made of charged particles, it's being ripped apart by the gravitational tidal forces, it's being ripped apart so severely that it gets ionized, it gets stripped into nuclei and electrons, and because those are charged, there are going to be electromagnetic forces there as well, and that's going to further accelerate and redirect these particles. And as they interact, they heat up. And they're going to produce radiation, because when you have a charged particle that accelerates through a magnetic field, it emits radiation. And so I can see, here's where the energy comes from. And maybe with good enough simulations, I can even sort of compute, how is this energy distributed in terms of kinetic, thermal, and radiation effects? But then you come to that next part of, what happens to that energy? What happens to that radiation, to those particles, when they interact with the rest of the galaxy? How does that energy get deposited into the matter in the galaxy? And then, how does that deposited energy behave? How does it affect star formation? How does it feed back onto the greater galaxy? I don't know the answer, and I presume that there are only a few aspects of that that you or anyone knows the answer to today.
Yeah, absolutely. There are some things we can constrain. We can measure how fast particles are moving that are being ejected when we look at these big jets coming out of galaxies. But we don't necessarily know how much material is in these jets. Constraining their temperatures can be difficult. There's so many question marks, and the problem is all these simulations need those variables to go into them, and so we need to find a way to figure out what the actual numbers are.
Can I ask you, one of the things that I like to sort of ask myself as a sanity check when I'm looking at something that's far away is to say, okay, we have some nearby objects that we can get good observations of that are analogs of what I'm hoping to find and examine and measure farther away. When we do our simulations of objects, can we successfully reproduce the types of objects that we see nearby? Or is there still gaps? Are there still gaps between what I expect to see because I've already seen it directly with my observations and what I am predicting in my simulations?
That's a great question. And the answer is both yes and no. Honestly, the biggest problem that we have with the sort of simulations that I use today is we're limited in how much we can resolve. We are looking at giant, giant chunks of the universe, 50 to 100 megaparsecs across. And there are trillions of, you know, elements of dark matter and gas and dust and stars and black holes that we're trying to keep track of. And just computationally, we can't do all of that and look at such big areas over the whole history of the universe and resolve down to very small scales. A lot of the things that we're talking about in terms of, you know, the material in an accretion disk and how that gets ejected from the black hole is not actually resolvable by these simulations. It's what we call subgrid physics. We have to sort of estimate the impact that these effects have on the larger scales that we can resolve. And so in order to, you know, put in the impact of the subgrid physics, we do look at analogs in the nearby universe. We do look at things where we've been able to constrain, for example, how fast gas is moving in these big jets and these radio lobes. And we take those variables from the nearby universe and we put them into our simulation. But in terms of resolving down to small scales where really seeing the detail nearby could help, we can't do that in our simulations anyways at this point. It's getting better all of the time, but it's still a pretty big limitation, I would say.
No, and that's always a challenge, right? Because what you want to do with your simulations is you want the entire simulation to encapsulate the entire physical system you're trying to simulate. You want something that's large enough that you're not just going to say like, oh, and then this goes off the edge of the box and it's gone. You don't want that to occur. But at the same time, when you have, say, you know, you're saying, you know, 50 to 100 megaparsecs is somewhere around, you know, 160 to 320 million light years on a side. Like this is a large area. This is as large as like a supercluster of galaxies. This is not just like something big like the Virgo cluster and the surrounding groups, but it's an even grander structure than that. And then you're saying, oh yeah, and we're starting from an individual black hole at the centers of one of the galaxies in this volume, and that's where the energy is coming from. And you can't do it. You can't have a simulation that simulates everything inside all the way down to that very, very high resolution, tiny, small scale, here's what's happening at the black hole, and then go all the way out to, oh, and by the way, we're going to see how this has effects going out for hundreds of millions of light years. It's just too big of a difference in scale. We can't simulate enough particles in our simulation to account for all of those effects. You would pretty much need a computer as powerful as the entire observable universe, like to have that many bits of information. And even today, even in 2024, you know, we're still limited to keeping track of maybe a few trillions of particles in a simulation. You can't simulate something with like 10 to the 50 something particles like you would need to really learn what you want from just raw brute force simulation. So you have to make approximations and finesses. And when you do that in the ways that you're saying, where you're saying, well, we're gonna make a model for how the energy gets injected. You know, because you can't actually simulate all of that in full, there are significant uncertainties that come along with that. I know there are lots of older people out there who throw up their hands and declare, oh, it's all crap because it's unreliable. And I don't think that's right, but I do think you still have to be mindful of how substantial those uncertainties can actually be.
Oh, absolutely. Something that I have seen and heard a lot when I talk to people about astrophysics is, you know, how do you know anything? You can't go out there, you can't touch it, you can't manipulate it. And then you hear these things about these simulations where there's approximations built into them. And I think that something that's important to keep in mind is that a vast majority of scientists, at least all of the ones I know, are very aware that there are these uncertainties built into our methods. And we address all of them in our papers, and we kind of are just limited to work within the confines of them. We are limited to the tools that we have, whether that be the resolution of a telescope or the, you know, computational load of our supercomputing clusters. And so we do what we can within them and, you know, try to be as aware as we can be about what uncertainties we're working with. That being said, the uncertainties, you know, can be significant in some things, but I wouldn't say that they're a reason to discount the results of modern astrophysics. Because we build these statistical uncertainties into our results, we are getting real results and real information about how the universe is working.
I mean, I would assume at the very least, you can come up with a reasonable range that you can say, look, here's the lower limit and here's the upper limit on how whatever aspect you're trying to simulate, energy injection, particle collisions, photon energy at various wavelengths, right? You can at least set upper and lower limits on what you're going to be able to experience, on what you're going to be able to have as a quantified effect in there. And if you put those into your simulations, you can at least put meaningful constraints on, you know, for example, the effect of feedback on the host galaxy and surrounding galaxies in its environment from AGN activity.
Absolutely. And I think the other thing I want to mention is that the simulations I work with are these really big ones that cover the scales of multiple galaxy clusters. But there are also people who do work modeling on much smaller scales that can actually resolve the details of the physics of an accretion disk around a black hole, for example. And we can learn things from those simulations and incorporate those effects into our broader ones. So it's not that we only have these simulations that are limited in their resolution. We have the ability to simulate at a bunch of resolutions. It's just a matter of you have to pick one scale that you're going to focus on. And then, you know, the rest, as you mentioned, the orders of magnitude are just too big. And so we can get some information from observation. We can get some information from the higher resolution simulations of black hole accretion and energy feedback. And we build those into our work.
Let me ask you, what are the issues? What are the problems with saying, oh, well, I simulated what happens around the black hole at high resolution there, and then I use the results from that simulation as an input into my coarser, lower resolution, larger scale simulation. And I think there are a lot of people who wonder, well, why can't I just do that? Why are there still uncertainties when I choose that method?
So when you take the output from these simulations that handle smaller scales, even the outputs of those are going to be on smaller scales than we can resolve in our simulations of the type that I use. So that transfer of information from the smaller scale simulation to these big cosmological scale ones, there's still a jump in orders of magnitude there. And so there still has to be some approximation of those effects.
Are you saying this is kind of akin to saying, like, well, if I know what's going on atomic scales, why is it a problem to simulate a human being? And the answer is, well, there are like 10 to the 28 atoms in a human being, and a human being is like 10 orders of magnitude larger in scale than an atom is. So yeah, you might be able to simulate an atom really well, and you might be able to simulate the environment around an active galactic nucleus very well, but simulating an atom doesn't tell you what's happening when you have 10 to the 28 atoms all bound together, and simulating one active galactic nucleus in a cluster that's, you know, got, I don't know, tens of thousands of galaxies and quadrillions of solar masses worth of stars. It's not like it's very easy to say, oh, I know what's happening on this little scale, and therefore I can just use it as an input into the big scale.
Yeah, exactly. We've been focusing a lot on these AGN feedback processes, but there is so much more than that that goes into big cosmological simulations. You have to care about star formation and stellar feedback, because as stars form and then when they die, they put energy out into the galaxy in a similar way to AGN do, just on different scales. You have to care about cooling. You have to care about chemical evolution of your gas. You have to care about interactions between galaxies. If galaxies are merging, you're going to have black holes interacting with each other, and that's a whole different type of simulation. And so it becomes a much more complex process.
In other words, AGN feedback is not the only type of important feedback at play. And if you, it would be like trying to make a cake and say, well, I understand butter. Why is there a problem making the cake? It's like, well, it takes a lot more than butter to make a cake, and it takes more than just AGNs to understand the full effect of feedback in an environment like this. So you kind of have to give it, you kind of have to account for every relevant thing, and you're really only trying to, you know, what you're trying to do is focus on one ingredient there and say, how does this ingredient play a role? But also, there are other ingredients there, and they all play a role together. And if you miss any one of them, you're going to get an incomplete and even biased picture.
Exactly.
If that's what's going on, are people who say, oh, well, if we just go to understand all the other ingredients, which are maybe easier than these AGNs, then can't we just look at whatever's missing and say, oh, that must be due to AGN? Or is that a wrong approach also?
I very much wish it were that simple, but unfortunately, all of the things that I've talked about in terms of how much we don't understand about AGN, there's a lot we don't understand about a vast majority of the other processes going on in and around a galaxy. Stellar feedback is a whole field of research where people are trying to answer similar questions to what I'm answering, and there's still big unknowns in that topic. People are looking a lot at gas behaviors in galaxies, but we don't know everything about what's going on with them, and there's uncertainties built into the treatment of that in our simulations as well. So if everything else were really well constrained, it would be a great way to understand the impact of AGN, but since everything has these uncertainties and errors built into it, we're kind of trying to build them all together.
I see. So you're really saying, look, you know, you have to understand that you have feedback from stellar activity and star formation, and you have feedback from stellar cataclysms like supernovae, and you have stellar feedback from tidal disruption events, and you have feedback from neutron star mergers and white dwarf mergers, and there are all of these other ways that feedback occurs besides from AGN. So let's not pretend that, oh, when we account for everything that we know how to account for, that whatever's left is only due to AGN. No, you've got to quantify everything that you can, as well as you can, as tightly as you can, and you're still going to have uncertainties there, and there's still going to be leftover effects, either positive or negative, that still persist. If you want to get this right, or as right as possible, you really do have to do all of this heavy lifting on all of the different fronts together.
Exactly. And I do want to just bring it around again, because we're talking so much about uncertainties and errors, that the ultimate goal here is not to kind of throw things into our simulations and be like, well, there's errors, but this is what's going on. We want to compare it to what we actually see in the universe so that we can make our simulations as good as possible and understand what's going on in the universe as well as possible too. So we're not just, you know, putting in these things with big error bars, we're actively trying to reduce the size of those error bars and get a solid understanding of the physical processes at play with the tools that we have now.
Yeah, because your goal isn't to just make the prettiest, most accurate simulation possible. Your goal is to say, hey, we want to understand this one. We want to understand this actual universe we have, the one we observe. And the way we do that is by saying, okay, when I look at this object, I can explain it in the context of this theory, because when I use this theory and I put these inputs into my simulation, here's what comes out of my simulation. And so when I look at these classes of objects, I know this is what's going on with them to some degree of confidence. And when I look at this other class of objects, I can say this is what's going on with them to some degree of confidence. And yeah, there might be some contamination. It might not be perfect. That probably has a lot to do with my uncertainties. But the goal is a more comprehensive understanding of the actual universe, not just writing a simulation that gives me things I feel better about.
Exactly.
So I know another thing you've talked about being extremely passionate about, in addition to, you know, the computational astrophysics work you do, is science outreach. And I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about how you got into that.
Absolutely. So when I was in my first year of grad school, I was really just kind of looking for a creative outlet. The transition to grad school can be difficult. It was having an impact on my mental health, and I wanted to do something that could kind of help get me re-excited about astrophysics, because I was getting so caught up in the minutiae of debugging my code every day. And so somewhat on a whim, I decided to make a video where I just talked about what I had talked to the astronomy lab I was TAing that day. I think I was talking about galaxy collisions and what happens when galaxies collide. And I made that video and I posted it on TikTok because, you know, it's a short video, it was an easy place to put it. And I just really loved that process of talking about something that was exciting to me and sharing it with people. And I just kept doing it. And so I have since then been making videos on TikTok and Instagram and YouTube. And really my ultimate goal with it is to make astronomy accessible, because I think we've spent this whole podcast talking about what I think is this fascinating idea of how black holes impact the galaxies that they live in. But for a lot of people, the first response might be, so what? This isn't going to change anything about how I live my life. It's not going to impact, you know, how my family grows or, you know, how I put food on the table. And I think astronomy is a field that the research is often done just for the sake of advancing the collective knowledge of humanity. But the way it's presented right now is in these highly technical scientific papers where a vast majority of humanity can't understand it. And so with the science outreach that I do, I really want to make astronomy understandable and fun and combat a lot of the misinformation that's online nowadays. And it's been a really rewarding thing for me that's become a big part of just my life as a graduate student, something I hope to continue in my career.
I know you've also been very excited about something that just happened to you, that you've been selected as an AstroBytes author. And for our listeners out there who don't know what AstroBytes is, can you tell them a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So AstroBytes is a website, it's a blog where graduate students will write summaries of recent astrophysics papers in a way that is much more accessible than the papers themselves. The kind of goal of the level is around an undergraduate who's maybe studying astronomy or physics. And it was a tool that I used a lot when I was an undergrad to help sort of decipher the technicalities of papers. And I think that it's a perfect example of making these results that are really interesting and, you know, spark a lot of people's curiosity, but a lot of people can't understand them, including often me. If I'm reading a paper that's outside of my specific field of expertise, a lot of times I'm very lost. And so I'm really excited to be part of this group who puts a lot of work into making sure that people can understand these papers and understand the research in an accurate and fun and interesting way.
You know, I think that's really important for two reasons. Number one, you talked about how the general public doesn't often understand what astronomers do, what scientists in general do, and why they do it, and what they learn from it and what it means. And I think that bringing that story to the world is a very important thing to do, because look, most of us are not astronomers. Like, you and I are both astrophysicists, but we're not typical. All across the world, there are probably only several thousand, maybe a few tens of thousands of people who get their PhDs in astronomy or astrophysics. This is not something that most people in the world know a whole lot about. But it's just as much a non-experts universe as it is an experts universe. The things we're discovering, the things we're learning about reality, these should be for everyone. This is something that I myself am very passionate about, where I want to bring these stories to anyone who's curious about learning it. You shouldn't have to know the advanced mathematics. You shouldn't have to get a PhD. You shouldn't need to go to graduate school for it to be able to share in the joys and wonders of it. And at the same time, you know, it's not like you can just learn astronomy and astrophysics once and then you're done with it. That's not how it works, right? There are all of these subfields that are constantly advancing. We've already talked about a number of aspects where, oh yeah, here's what we thought 20 years ago, here's what we thought 40 years ago, here's what we thought 60 years ago, and we don't think those things anymore because of all the new things we've learned. So when you talk about something like outreach for the general public and making TikTok and YouTube videos, that's very important. But when you talk about doing the AstroBytes type of work that you do, what you're doing is you're basically translating from astrophysicist into educated non-expert, right? You're basically translating this from a language that only a few thousand people speak to a language that millions of people speak. And when you go to TikTok or YouTube, now you're trying to go further to a language that hundreds of millions or even billions of people think. And so I think this is extremely important when it comes to science outreach, that these things we're discovering, that other people are discovering and finding, they're interesting, they're profound, and they need to be put in their proper context to be brought to a wider audience. And so if that's something you're passionate about, for me, the hard part is learning the science. The easy part is learning to communicate it to others, because communicating it to others is just a skill. It's like anything, like swimming or painting or playing the piano. If you want to get good at it, do it. Practice it. I guarantee you that you are a better science communicator today than you were even 2 years ago, just by virtue of the fact that you've been doing it for longer.
Oh, absolutely. I think that it was something that I very much started on a whim. And so because of that, I was starting from a not very knowledgeable place about how to do it. And over the years, I've gotten a lot better. And I think something that's helped a lot is seeing the desire that people have to learn about astronomy. You know, you talked about how this is everyone's universe and everyone has, you know, a right to understand it. But I think everyone also, or not everyone, but most people really want to understand it. Astronomy 101 is one of the most popular gen ed science requirement classes because it sounds cool. People think space is really interesting, and people get excited when they feel like they can understand what's going on with it, or they see a really pretty picture and are able to see beyond the pretty picture what's actually happening in the structures, what the physics is. And so I think that's been something that has been one of the biggest things I've learned, is that people are excited about it, and you can feed off that excitement and help them learn and build on that excitement. And it's a really wonderful thing.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you completely. And I think understanding what people are passionate and excited about, understanding what drew them in, can help you craft your message as far as bringing them along on this journey. Because you and I and everyone else who does this for a living, we're going through a journey where we're learning more and more about the universe. And there is a demand for that. There are lots of people out there who they want to know what it is that we know, what's happening on the cutting edge, what does the frontier look like, where are we, and where are we headed? And that's something I also want to ask you about. When we talk about where your field is headed, imagine that it's 10 years from now, it's 20 years from now. What breakthroughs, what are things that we have open questions about today that you have a hunch might be things we answer, things we know the answer to 10 or 20 years from now? What are some big possible breakthroughs that you're looking forward to seeing if they happen?
That is a fantastic question. I have some that are kind of on a dream wish list. I would love to understand more about dark matter. I've done research on dark matter, and I think it would be really amazing to directly detect a particle. But I don't know if I can have a hunch that that will happen within the next few decades. I think one that is more likely to really advance our understanding is where these supermassive black holes come from. We talked a lot today about the impact that they have, but there's still a lot of questions in terms of how they form. And in the past couple of years, there have already been big breakthroughs in terms of modeling direct collapses of clouds, or the formation of really large stars that could lead to bigger black holes than we see forming from stellar objects in today's universe. And I think with, you know, JWST and these tools that can probe the early universe, that's a question that I'm personally really curious about, that I think we could really start to narrow down in the next decade or so, I hope.
Yeah, I think so too. The discovery of these, what we call overmassive black holes, where, you know, normally in the biggest, most massive black holes we find within galaxies, they make about a tenth of a percent of the mass found in stars in those galaxies. But when we look to the very early universe, we see that some galaxies have supermassive black holes at their centers, where that ratio isn't 1,000 to 1 between stellar mass and black hole mass, but it's 100 to 1, 10 to 1. and possibly in one case that was recently discovered by a joint effort between Chandra X-ray data and JWST infrared data, it looks like we found one just about 600 or 700 million years after the Big Bang, where the ratio looks like it's 1-to-1. And that strongly favors a direct collapse model rather than a it formed from stars model. I think that is something that it's not only reasonable to be hope will be answered, but I think we may even get lucky and get some sort of direct answer by finding what we call population 3 stars directly, by finding these population of pristine stars and seeing, well, what do these stars do? How do they live? How do they die? Do they form black holes? And how massive do those stars and black holes get that they form? Because if we see that and we say, oh, here's the black holes they form, now we're going to know for certain, can these explain all of the black holes that we see in the universe? Or do we need a direct collapse or some other exotic mechanism to account for these early massive black holes that we find?
Right. I'm so excited by it. It's one of the things that I think has been the most wonderful about JWST is finding these really early objects that can help us kind of prove or disprove ideas.
And it's kind of amazing, too, because even though this isn't your field in particular, you're really interested in finding out about it, both for knowledge's sake and also because it's relevant to your research.
Absolutely. Everything in astronomy is connected. You can get very focused on one specific research question, and if you're getting a PhD, you're kind of forced into doing that. But I really enjoy taking a step back and seeing, you know, how these AGN impact the gas reservoirs, impacts how stars form and the chemical composition of those stars, and that impacts how much material is around to form planets. Like, you can connect everything in astronomy to everything else, and I really love that about the universe, how interconnected it all is.
I love that as well, and thank you for sharing that with me and our listeners, and also thank you for a wonderful and far-ranging conversation, Skylar. Before we let you go, I'd love to ask you, do you have any final thoughts that you would like to share with our listeners out there?
You know, I was thinking about the course that this conversation has took, where we kind of started building on the ideas of AGN and got really into what they're doing. And then we kind of took a turn and started talking about the difficulties and how we model it and the uncertainties and what we really don't know yet. And I really love that our conversation took that turn, because it feels a lot like how I have done science. It feels a lot like how science works, where you start off talking about what you know and what's exciting, and then you sort of realize where the gaps are and what the uncertainties are. And, you know, we talked a lot about how we're going to try to fill those gaps and those uncertainties. And I hope that, you know, anyone listening to this can kind of take that away, that this was, to me, it felt like a very realistic depiction of the scientific process in astrophysics today, which I just thought was fun.
Well, that's really great to hear. I will fess up to all of you listening out there that part of the reason my conversations with my guests tend to go like this is because I want to learn these things. I learned about these things back when I was in grad school, you know, 20 some odd years ago, and then I didn't, you know, research them further. So when I talk to a new guest, a young rising star in the field, an expert in something I myself am not an expert in, I want to know, are the things I learned back then still correct? Are the things that have happened since relevant? Have they changed our picture of it? Are there things on the cutting edge that I don't know that everyone should know? And where is this field headed? What do the frontiers look like? And what do the next steps look like? And thanks to PhD candidate Skylar Grayson of Arizona State University, we're a step closer to that when it comes to active galaxies, feedback, the thermal Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect, and a whole lot more. So Skylar, thank you for being my guest here, and thanks to all of you out there for tuning in. The Starts With a Bang podcast is only made possible through the generous donation of our Patreon supporters, and I'd like to thank everyone donating at the $5 a month level and up. Thanks go to Chad Marler, Jeff Bonwick, Lainey Chewis, Rob Hansen, Samir Kumar, Tim Graham, Aaron Weiss, Chris Jakutas, Dominic Turpin, John Methot, John Van Balaguyan, Matt Conroe, Pattern Shift, Pete Smoyer, Pierre Franson, C. Green Mango, Stefan Bernegger, William Blair, Amira Sosnick, Andy and Wall, Benish Tech LLC, Brian Terry, David Charney, David Gilton, and David Hibbets, David Wallach, George Church, Hirolamo Castaldo, James Franklin, John Kozura, Joseph Dvorak, Ken Lapre, Kili Aopu, Laird Whitehill, Mark Armstrong, Matt Glasser, Nick Winland, Patrick Den, Pedro Texera, Rafael Wojciech, Randall Slimak, Rick DeWitt, Ron Schiffman, Sean Foley, Steve Guderian, Adam Robinson, Adrian Griffiths, Alan Parikh, Andres Chovanec, Arnulfo Zepeda, Ben Head, Bob Shire, Brainwise, Brett Minder, Cameron Sowards, Carl Ittings, Casey Haskins, Dan Steelen, Dana Bridges, David Tascioni, David Wolf, Diana Nevins, Eric Zetterbaum, Flo, Fraser Kane, Glenn McDavid, Ira Cohen, James Bryson Hyatt, James Nance, James Page, Jason Luttrell, Jason McCampbell, Javier Zazo, Catherine S., Kelly Kudrick, Lockwood Carlson, Mark Berger, and Mark Bloor, Mark Langston, Mark Van Coy, Matt Reno, Michael Hall, Michael Prochota, Michael Savuto, Naked Bunny with a Whip, Nathan Hannon, Neil Flood, Owen Mann, Pam Harris, Paul Lester, Pavel Zuzelski, Phil Hallenborg, Philip Francis, Rich Weigel, Richard Schwartz, Rob Thibodeau, Roger Dennis, Ron Lyle, Rushin Shah, Steve Nordhoff, Stuart Lending, Terry McKeon, Tom Van Scotter, Tomas Ault, Tomas Walgren, Wayne Pierkarski, Weller Tractor Salvage, William Vandenhuvel, and Young Co. S. Thanks to all of you for tuning in, and we'll see you back here next time for more Starts With a Bang.